Lord's office. I would like to come in and read the Word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you?
There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schneid is brilliant, and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. It's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Into the dust bit of history. Yeah, we're pre-recorded tonight so I could do my duty as a member of the LSB, Local Station Board. But we do have a program for you, and the bulk of it will be something we haven't heard in a very long time. Gene Shepherd live at the Village Limelight, his Saturday night program with hamburgers and greasy kids as well. The complete program from 60 years ago to this very day, September 10th, 1966. It's got the complete 5 minutes of news at the half-hour break, and maybe more. We shall see. And this is The Dustbin of History here on WBAI New York.
WOR 710 Radio New York. It's 10:30.
Listen, wouldn't it be great if we just kept that up for 1 hour and a half? You know, 45,000 guys tune in and say, oh, I missed another one. Oh. You know, it's like this sexual revolution I keep reading about. I wonder how many people out there are bugged because they ain't been invited yet. Or is it all... by the way, speaking of revolution, I've got a little thing here that tonight I'm going to do a football thing. How many of you saw the first football game of the year on TV today? Well, I'll tell you, it's getting more significant every moment. Right in the middle of the, you know, the halftime, these guys are playing football out there. I'm sitting there waiting, you know, for the big halftime display. They're going to do the big thing. And the announcer, Chris Shankly, kept saying, yes, we're going to have a big halftime display. It's very exciting. Very exciting. Now they're getting ready up the stands there. And I wait. They shoot the gun off. The halftime starts, and the entire stands spell out Milton Berle. Yeah, I mean, it's showbiz is getting endemic. They spell out Milton Berle, and then the entire band plays a salute to Ben Casey. Well, now, speaking of showbiz, I have a note here that I clipped. Very significant little notes all over the place these days. I clipped this out of the New York Times, and that's an official newspaper. They print only the news that's fit to print. I think that's the snottiest slogan I ever heard, you know. The key word is fit, you know. I can just see you're an axe murderer in Brooklyn and you don't make it. You only make the news, you know. By the way, speaking of the daily news, how many of you are fans of the third page of the news? That's the orgy page. Yeah, you know, that's the one that says Alderman nabbed in Love Nest in Brooklyn. Or you know, there's another one always they have, 28 nabbed in Love Nest in Brooklyn High School. And it shows these guys being hurried into the wagon. And you read this. I sit day after day, you know, I go to the barber shop and I read this paper, and I feel cheated. I was never hurried into a wagon in my entire life, and I have a vague suspicion that everybody secretly would like to have that happen. Well, look. Do you realize that all we'd have to do here would be to turn out the lights? See, the rest of the world thinks we're doing a show here. We got plenty of chicks here. What's the matter? We got 400 pounds of grapes waiting. Look at our, let's go! Hey, now, here we're talking. All of a sudden, you hear in the distance, wouldn't it be great to be part of the first radio show in America that got busted in midstream? We now take you back to the studio for some John Gambling tapes. Well, you know, here, I picked this up out of the Times. I think this is significant. It says, One Nation Under God. It says, a message to all God-fearing Americans. Stand up and be counted as Americans that believe in the principle of one nation, indivisible and invincible. And then underneath it, it says, it's a bumper, you know, a bumper sticker they're selling. And underneath it, it says, listen to this, special, rush your order today to avoid being disappointed. I think that's significant. I mean, seriously, you know, speaking of being disappointed, I'm watching this football game scene. I think, you know, it's all showbiz now. I think a lot of people think of God as that big agent in the sky. You know, he's either that big agent or he's that magnificent producer who is somehow related to David Merrick and he's produced a bad show. You know? I believe seriously that all men walking around are so imbued with showbiz today that everybody sees himself as playing some kind of a part in some vast, fantastic drama. Now, the question is, are you just a bit player? Or are you a featured player, you know, like E.G. Marshall that comes in and says friendly things? You know? Or are you, do you see yourself as a star that has not yet been discovered in the great drama of life? Yeah. That's the problem with showbiz. And I'm sitting there, see, I'm watching this football game today. And I see the band march out. How many of you saw the greatest band display in Western history on the last day of the football season last year? Big football game, see. It's one of these big bowl games. And I'm sitting there. It's in full color. And I'm up at the station. And we got this color TV set, and I'm watching. You want to see what you can do with the color. You can sit there. You can make everybody's face purple. You can make your own obscene pictures, you know. Oh, yeah, working with the knobs, right, see? So, oh, yeah, it looks like people are marching through some awful stuff. And so... You'll have to explain that one back in Hackensack. So I'm watching this TV show last year, and I'm beginning to see that there's a pattern that is beginning to form. And the announcer says, and now the number one band in the nation will give a salute to the number one television show in the nation. You remember when they used to just make a big M? Or they used to make a big USC? No, not now. See, I'm watching these guys. It's a fantastic showbiz band. They come out, and they do not have marching order. It's choreographed. Yeah, you know, they all come out swinging, you know. And the tubas are going up and down, you know. Well, they march around, they swing. And I'm watching. Geez, what's going to happen? And they start peeling off, see. They're making a formation, and I can't believe what I'm seeing. They make a gigantic hypodermic needle. Did you see that one?
Yeah.
A giant hypodermic needle. It stretched the entire length of the football field. I can see about 400 junkies coming through, you know. And they're wondering, you mean they're putting it on TV now? They got a commercial on for a pot. But they're selling H, man. And they make this great big hypodermic needle, see? And then you see a whole bunch of the band are inside the needle. I'm waiting to see what happens, you know? And the plunger starts coming down. And the tubas, they go out the needle, you know, they squeak out. And they spell a gigantic ouch. And all the while, they're playing the Ben Casey theme. Well, I watched this scene, and I say, well, incidentally, since obviously there is a revolution going on in our country, you know, mores, I keep thinking of great things that bands could make. Coast to coast, you know? You know, just out there, there it is. It says, now a salute to the pill. Have you had a feeling that the pill is showbiz, too? You know? I watched this thing today, and I thought to myself, you know, I just wonder. I watched the sousaphone players. You know, as an old ex-tuba player, I'm always drawn to looking at the sousaphone players. Perhaps you don't know that the people in bands have an entirely different world from the football team and from the rest of the student body. And once you've been a peckhorn player, in a marching band, you always think of yourself as a peckhorn player. You don't think of yourself as an account executive, you know, or a dentist. You're secretly a French horn player. And you are looking at an out-of-work sousaphone player. Me, I always see myself that way. And sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, when it's dark, and I wake up, you know, you have those moments of insight. I feel this ache. It's a slight ache, and it's where my old sousaphone pressed down. You know, I just feel it, and I wake up, and I'm halfway through the second course of Semper Fidelis, and I'm driving in towards that last final crescendo. Then I wake up. I look around. I feel that little sting of the mouthpiece on my lips, and today, watching the band marching around out there, Chris Schenkel said, everywhere, all over the country, kids are going to go back to school. this week. And I thought, so are band members. I'm an old ex-band member, see? And I'm going to tell you one of the great moments in my life, one of the absolute peak moments in my life, was the time that I auditioned as a sousaphone player. Have you ever auditioned, any of you? Oh, that's a hellish experience. Oh, I'll tell you, when you audition, you get up on a stage, you stand up there, you know, there's a piano player half asleep, and they give you this, you know, they give you this book, and you say, to be or not to be. That is the question. They say, that's enough, that's enough. We'll call you. And you say, oh, another one. Another one, auditioning all our lives. Well, I'm this kid, see, and I bet not one of you know how a sousaphone player, you know, a sousaphone is what most people call the tuba. That is not a tuba. That big horn, you know, with the big bell, that is a sousaphone. The tuba does not go around your neck. The tuba is an upright instrument that you sit like this and play, and you always hope girls will play it. And they do once in a while, and it adds a little spice to the band. Oh, yeah. Usually little short, fat girls, but you know you settle for anything when you're in high school. I bet, seriously, you've never really wondered or asked how a kid gets to be a sousaphone player. Well, I'm going to tell you how I got to be a sousaphone player. It's a sad, tragic story. I came from a totally non-musical family. My father's idea of music was to listen to his Crosley, and he always waited for them to play the Indian Love Call. That was his idea of music, see. And so one day, I'm coming home from school. You know that great bland feeling? You're just coming home. Have you ever thought of the 18 million days that you have lived through that you don't even remember? Seriously, that you don't even remember at all. And if you were suddenly thrown back, you ever have those insights that if you were suddenly thrown back into this day, you wouldn't remember it at all? You couldn't even recognize the people. Was I ever here? You know? Well, it was one of those days. I'm just walking along. You know, my mind is turned off. I wonder how many hours out of the day your mind is turned off. You know, just going tick, 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 tick. You know, you're just a lump of silly putty walking. You know, 90% of the day you walk along Fifth Avenue, you know, people look, people bump, and you just go along hour after hour. Well, I'm walking along, see, and I see on the other side of the street, I see this big silver thing. And it's about a half a block ahead of me. And it's moving in the same direction. See, I'm walking along. And all of a sudden it goes boop. You know, I see this thing, it goes boop. And you could feel the ground jiggle, you know. Yeah, you could feel, you know, your windows, you hear people opening the windows and looking out. I see this big silver thing. See, I'm walking. My mind is slowly coming into focus now. I recognize that under that gigantic silver piece of metal is my buddy Schwartz. You heard me speak of Schwartz. There he is, see? Schwartz. So I catch up with him. Here's Schwartz with this big thing. I said, what do you got, Schwartz? He said, I got a horn. I said, but where did you get it, Schwartz? You know, nobody had ever had an instrument in our neighborhood. Nobody. We did not live in that kind of neighborhood where all the kids at the age of six are sent to take piano lessons. Or violin lessons, or accordion lessons, you know, that kind of jazz. None of us. We just grew naturally. You know, Oh, yeah, and for that reason, everybody who came out of our neighborhood had the natural hates of humanity. Like, you couldn't stand people that sang in high voices. You know, that soprano. I've never been able to stand sopranos ever since that neighborhood. Oh, yeah, because we had two of them in the neighborhood who sang. You know, that kind of thing. I see a fairy in my garden. Oh, yeah, that was great moments in the PTA. Oh, yeah, with Mrs. Pullen, you know, I'd be sitting down there with... I was always in these toothpaste, these oral hygiene pageants. Have you ever been in one? Well, I was always playing a bad molar, see? Yeah, I had this uniform, you know, it was all big tooth, you know, I had a big rotten place. And this girl, this chick I had a thing on, always was playing a toothbrush. Yeah, she played correct brushing, I believe is what her total, what she was really called in the program, see. Schwartz always played Listerine. And so, yeah, Miss Shields would say, and now our group, our dramatic group from second grade, will now give you their oral hygiene pageant, which was such a success at last year's PTA meeting in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I would walk out on the stage, see, and Miss Bundy would play dramatic music. Dum, 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 dum. And over here, Kashmir Wisnowski would hold up a sign that would say, bad teeth. That's how I got in showbiz. Oh, yeah, you know, I was a method's bad molar. And I remember the great moment in the pageant when she would come close to me. Eileen Akers would come close to me wearing her toothbrush. And she would bend over and brush me. And I would turn around and I would say, get me back on the shoulder there, little. Oh, it was a great love scene, see, very symbolic. And I remember one day sitting there backstage, you know, waiting. I'm dressed as a tooth. Well, it's not easy playing teeth. What's the matter with you guys? You know, Richard Burton would be, you know, have trouble in it. So I'm sitting back there, and here's the toothbrush sitting next to me. And out in front, I remember Miss Pullen, Mrs. Pullen, rather. She was a tall, thin lady with a red dress. The kind of lady that has a bun, you know, in the back of the head. And she is singing. And you can hear it throughout the whole gym. And she is singing, oh, there is a fairy in my garden. And every day I go to see him. Ding, ding, ding. And the piano's going thung, da, thung. And from that day on, I have always hated people who sang in high voices. And I've always suspected there are fairies in the end of everybody's garden. Little did I realize, until I came to the village, I was right. Anyway. Now, are you applauding for or against, gang? Which is it? Have you had a feeling, though, seriously, lately, that they're taking over everywhere? Have you seen those beer commercials in the warehouse? Oh, did you ever see anything like that where six truck loaders come out and they go, oh, we've got to get the beer in the warehouse. You know, their faces are painted orange, you know, that whole bit. Well, anyway, you know, I'm sitting there, see, and I formed this fantastic hatred of high-pitched tenors from that time on. And the band, this band that I was in, played day after day for the various PTAs. Now, how did I get in the band? This is one of the great moments of my life. And I'm about to describe it. In fact, once in a while, when I go home, occasionally, my mother will look up from the meatloaf she's making. She has a myth going that I like meatloaf. She does not know that I have taken to eating lobsters. If she knew that, she'd go, ooh, ish. She never quite understands the stuff they eat out here in the East, you know, like clams and things. And so, once in a great while, when I see her, she says, do you still practice? Now, what is she referring to? Well, here is Schwartz. Now, how many of you, as people, when you were kids, your whole life has been changed by something some other kid did? I mean, it's very subtle. You'd have to think back on your life that you were drawn into something because of something another kid did. Well, Schwartz changed my life. Here he is with this horn. You know, I'm walking alongside of him. He never did this before, you know? Up to this time, Schwartz was just a pretty fair second baseman, you know? Now he's got this fantastic thing. And he goes, boop. I say, Schwartz, let me try it. He says, it's mine. It's you don't know how to do it. I'm walking along. And he goes, boop. Oh, and the fantastic, that terrible green specter of envy began to grow inside of me. I had to have one of those horns. Schwartz, boom. So up the steps he goes to his house. He's gone. And I go walking home. It's dark. It's getting a little bit along towards fall. I go in the kitchen. You know, can you remember when you were a kid just going in the kitchen? Nobody's there. There's the linoleum all around. I lived in a linoleum world. Our entire house was covered with linoleum. It was made that way because, you know, you could skate all the way through the house. Yeah, we lived in that kind of house. You know, if you wanted to throw up, you just did, you know? Well, we didn't have any rugs or anything like that, you know. We lived in this. And so we had this blue and white linoleum. I'm sitting there. And way off in the distance, I hear, boo. It's that damn Schwartz. And then I hear out in the yard, I hear a ball bouncing against the side of the house. You know that dunk, dunk. This is Flick, see? Let me know he's there. See, dunk, dunk. I walk out. I said, Flick. He says, yeah, let's play ball. And just then you hear, boo. Little did we realize that beauty and art had come to Hammond, Indiana. Aesthetic pleasures. You can hear, boo. I said, Flick, that's Schwartz blowing a horn. He says, Schwartz blowing a horn. I says, yeah. And so we went and stood under his window. And you could hear him, boo. He's practicing the horn. So the next day, on the way to school, he's got this thing on his head. And all I've got is a geography book. You know, I had my geography book, and I had all kinds of stuff in it. You know, I never really read the geography. I had all kinds of other stuff, seeing him walk along. Yeah, I used to steal dirty books from George's news agency down there. If he ever finds out, I'm in trouble, even now, you know. And so I'm walking along with my geography book, and Schwartz has got this horn, and I had to ask him. I said, Schwartz, how did you get it? He says, Mr. Melton gave it to me. I says, Mr. Melton? He says, yes, Mr. Melton has the band. I think, and this was the key word, he says, I think there is one more tuba left. I said, you mean I could get one? It never occurred to me I could play anything, see? He says, yeah, come on in. We'll ask him. I walked in behind Schwartz. The first time I ever was in the band room, you know? When you're in school, you always hear about the band room. Well, I went in for the first time, and there's big racks all over, you know, these tubas and all over. I could see these trombones walk in. And here's Mr. Melton. He was one of those teachers that you always hear about, but you never quite see. His name was always on little placards, you know, little posters. But you never really saw Mr. Melton. He was a gray, sort of tall man, had a red neck, and he played the flute. One awful day, which it will always go down into my mind as one of the great abortions of art history, was the day that Mr. Melton played Cherubirabim on his flute. And Mrs. Pullen sang a soprano obbligato. So he was that kind of a guy, see, tall, thin man. And I walk in. And here's Schwartz. He's in, you know. Got a big horn. Mr. Melton says, have you been practicing?
Paul
says,
yeah.
I brought another one. Mr. Melton looked at me, and he comes over and he grabs my shoulders. That's the way they test for talent, you know. It really is. He grabs my shoulders and just turn around. He reaches up, and he takes this thing down. Oh, it had a bell. Great, big, beautiful gold bell, see? And he takes it. He says, stand still, stand up. And he hangs it down over me. And there it was. My first instant. This first moment of true glory. Whew. Maybe you don't know what a sense of power a sousaphone gives a man. There it is, see? And I start to sway a little bit, you know. I mean, you're not used to 400 pounds of brass on you. He says, sway a little bit like this. He says, watch the knees. He says, now brace your knees. He says, all right, now hold still now. He says, now pucker your lips. He says, put them into the mouthpiece. He says, all right. And the mouthpiece, by the way, on a sousaphone. I mean, it's like kissing the radiator grill of an Oldsmobile, you know. And, yeah, here's this big thing, see. It's like a big brass plumber's helper looking you right in the eye, see. So here it is, see. So he says, all right, now say this. And all the while, Schwartz is standing over there real snotty, you know. He's the veteran. He's had his 2 days now, you know. And he says to me, he says, now say this. Two. And it comes back. You know, the first thing that happens with a sousaphone is that you go two, it holds it for a second, and then it stuffs it back into you, and it comes out your ear, you know? Oh, yeah, a sousaphone fights back. This is not an easy instrument. See, so I go two. He says, try it again. He says, but put your gut into it. He says, back up against the wall and push. I wait for a couple of seconds, and then it goes, boom! Hooray! 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 And Mr. Melton says, you've got talent. He says, try another one and press down the first valve. I press the first valve down. I wait. And then it goes, boom. He says, you have just blown a C natural. And immediately following the news, I will tell you how to play an A flat. Let's hear it.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. Some people remain indifferent. They read newspapers, magazines, and small reviews, yet nothing disturbs them. They stay above the news, above the harsh realities of war, racial strife, political corruption. Walter Kiernan is one man who cares. He doesn't play it safe. Each weeknight at 7:30, Kiernan enters the arena to deliver one man's opinion. He shakes people. He makes them think. Not everyone may agree with Kiernan, but you can be sure of one thing. They respect him for his frank, honest views. They respect a man who can still think for himself. Kiernan probes issues that some people would rather forget. He's not angry, just extremely witty, and his wit touches the conscience. There are few news commentators around these days, so Walter Kiernan is especially welcome. A program that asks you to comment, that urges you to react and act. Walter Kiernan's One Man's Opinion, 7:30 each weeknight, here on WOR Radio. This is WOR AM, 710 on your dial in New York. Stay tuned now for Ed Pettit and all the late news.
On Monday, September 12th, you'll be able to decide whether or not the new evening World Journal Tribune was worth waiting for.
Good evening, everyone. Here is the late hour news, Ed Pettit reporting. The Viet Cong have killed or maimed 500 persons in a bid to wreck weekend elections in South Vietnam. They're still at it tonight, but the voters are going to the polls and apparently in good numbers. There were long lines at polling places in Saigon today, and moderately heavy voting is reported elsewhere, though in the old city of Hue, hotbed of anti-government feeling, there were relatively few voters waiting when the polls opened there. Government officials hope for a turnout of at least 60%, which they say will clearly show where voter sympathy lies. In the air war, not much ground action. A hit-and-run mortar and small arms attack on the U.S. airstrip 100 miles above Saigon, and a brief clash 30 miles south of Saigon, resulting in 30 enemy dead. Our pilots say they encountered and traded with three enemy MiGs today, shot up three trains on the Hanoi to Peking line, and sunk at least one of five North Vietnamese patrol boats. Senate leader Mike Mansfield now concedes that the civil rights bill, with its hotly contested open housing provision, simply does not have much chance of passing. But he does believe there'll be enough lawmakers on hand on Monday to permit debate to begin. Louisiana Senator Alan Ellender predicts the administration will throw in the sponge sometime next week. In a bid to take the pressure off interest rates today, the Treasury instructed federal agencies not to borrow from private lenders for the rest of the year. And the president signed legislation that will channel more money into the mortgage market and thus ease the money squeeze for home buyers and builders. Next Monday is the new date for the Gemini 11 shot. There was trouble today with the Agena target rocket. Yesterday it was a fuel leak in the Gemini rocket, so astronauts Gordon and Cooper will go Monday if all is ready. The American Nazi Party marched through a Negro part of Chicago today, and except for 750 police who protected them, there might have been serious trouble. Negroes pelted the marchers with rocks. One bounced a vial of acid off a policeman's helmet. Four Negroes were arrested. Nazi Party leader Lincoln Rockwell was picked up in connection with an earlier rally, and his big Chicago Coliseum rally fizzled tonight when only 65 showed up. A diplomatic source in Miami, otherwise not identified, says Brazil, outspokenly opposed to Castro, has secretly shipped him 8,000 tons of maize corn. The Italian news agency says the Vatican and Yugoslavia have reestablished relations they broke in 1952. And Mount Etna, the famous and often frightfully destructive Sicilian volcano, was spouting fire and cinders 3,500 feet in the air today, and no one was hurt. Turning now to sports, in baseball, in the National League, St. Louis 6, Pittsburgh 5, Chicago 12, the Giants 3. The Dodgers beat Houston 1-0 in 10 innings, Cincinnati 2, Philadelphia 1, and Atlanta 3, the Mets 2. In the American League, Minnesota 7, Baltimore 2, White Sox 1, Washington 0, California 9, Cleveland 2, Yankees 5, the Red Sox 1, and Kansas City 5, Detroit 0 in the 8th inning. Cassius Clay retained the heavyweight title today with a 12th round TKO of German challenger Carl Middleberger. Fred Stoll and John Newcomb will battle tomorrow for the U.S. Tennis Singles Championship. Stoll beat Roy Emerson 6-4, 6-1, and 6-1. Newcomb upset the title holder Santana 6-3, 6-4, 6-8, and 8-6. For the women's crown, it'll be Nancy Ritchie against Maria Bueno of Brazil. In college football, Baylor beat Syracuse 35-13. In pro ranks, third period score, Green Bay Packers 21, the Colts 3. Second period score in the American League, Houston 14, Oakland nothing. Here now is the weather outlook for New York City and vicinity. Clear and cool tonight, low near 60 degrees. Tomorrow, fair and cool, high in the 70s, and continued fair and cool tomorrow night and Monday. Present Manhattan reading 72 degrees, humidity 53%, wind is out of the northwest at 7 miles an hour. The barometer reads 29.94 inches and is steady, and the THI currently stands at 68. And that's the late hour news, Ed Pettit reporting. Have a nice weekend. In a moment, back to Gene Shepherd at the Village Limelight.
This is WORAM, 710 on your dial in New York. Correct Eastern Daylight Saving Time is now 5 minutes past 11 o'clock.
And we're listening to Gene Shepherd live at the Village Limelight 60 years ago to this very day, September 10th, 1966. Let's get back to it. And this is the Dustbin of History here on WBAI New York.
Here, big bellow when we go on here. Boo! WOR is the only radio station that does a true public service. All the other radio stations and TV stations that I know of provide you with love figures. We provide you with a hate figure. All right, come and get me. Yeah. Boo! Boo! Oh, man, I'll tell you, it's just, you can just feel it in the air here, can't you? Yeah, I mean, there's that slight... How many of you remember that movie of Henry VIII? You know, when old Henry's sitting there and he's got this big, fantastic piece of meat with Charles Laughton. You ever see that scene? He's got this big piece of meat. It looks like a whole leg of a cow or something. Yeah, and he takes it and he goes, ah! He looks around and he throws it over his shoulder. And six mastiffs grab it. Rah! Somehow, I'm reminded of the limelight. You know, somebody here wanted me to tell a story, though. A curious... You know, that business of the band intrigues me. And I want to finish the story of that band. Because once I got the sousaphone, it led to one of the great moments in my life. Actually getting it was just one of those things. I was excited. But I can recall walking out in the sunshine 10 minutes after I got my sousaphone. First of all, you've got to realize when you're walking down the street with a sousaphone on, people look. Yeah, it was the first time in my life anybody ever actually looked at me. I mean, really, you know? I was beginning to understand showbiz, see? I've got this thing on now, and Schwartz is on one side of the street. I'm on this side of the street, and we're going home. And Schwartz would go, toom. And then I'd go, boop. I was great at that C natural note. Schwartz would hit that beautiful B flat. We go, boop. Then he would go, boop, boop, boop. Now I'm going up the stairs. This is one of those terrible times. Do you recall when you were a kid? We all do this. Every generation, apparently, at least in America, supersedes the one before it. In other words, really cuts it. Goes beyond the one just before it. How many of you remember that brief, terrible moment in your life when you realized that your father was an ignoramus? I mean, you know, and for the first time in your life, you're sitting there at the supper table, and you're looking at your dad, see? And you begin to realize that he has a Neanderthal jaw. You know, and you see those great bulging eyebrows, and you recall pictures that you saw of Og, son of fire. You know, the caveman, you look at the old man, and he gets up, and for that terrible moment when you realize that your dad goes through his whole life with a matchstick sticking out of his thumb, you know. Did you have a father that had a matchstick sticking out of his mouth all the time? Either that or a toothpick, you know, talking like. Yeah, always a toothpick. And he would come into the house. I remember that terrible moment when I discovered it. I am starting to date a girl. I'm about, 11 or 12. Well, not really date. I was standing in front of her house. You know, I was looking at her house a lot, you know, that kind of stuff. I'd walk past it once in a while, you know. And I remember getting invited in. I got invited, you know, that great moment when you get invited into the kitchen. And I'm in there in Esther Jane Albury's house, see. This was the girl that I was nutty about in school. Now I'm in her house. And it looks very different from our house. Very different. First of all, everything in the kitchen was white. They're one of these white kitchens. They have a white refrigerator. They have beautiful sink with stainless steel. I'm standing in there. Mrs. Alberry is making the two of us a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And what got me right away was that she used butter. I came from an oleo house. And my mother never even colored it. It was always the color of lard, you know. I'm looking down there, and she's got the high-priced spread. You know, the one they have the euphemism for, see? And she's putting this on there, and she's putting on the peanut butter. Now, my mother, when she put peanut butter on a peanut butter sandwich, would put a piece about the size of a half dollar in the middle of 4 pounds of bread. I mean, this lady put peanut butter on, you know? She's putting it all over there, and she puts the jelly on. She said, what kind of jelly do you want? In our house, you just got jelly, you know? It was purple stuff. Didn't have any name, you know? So Esther Jane says, Ma, I'll have strawberry preserves. I'll have strawberry preserves. And Mrs. Alberry put some on there, and here they were, the strawberries. See, so put the bread standing in the kitchen. See? And I could see in the next room a genuine dining room. You know, the kind of dining room that has a lace tablecloth on the table, and in the middle of the table is this bowl, and in the middle of the bowl are these wax bananas. I mean, it was a very genteel house, see? And in the middle of our dining room table, there was always a can of sardines that my old man was half through with, you know? He says, don't touch it until I get home, you know? You know, that kind of life. So our house was always totally paved between visits from important people. It was totally paved with newspapers. You ever lived in a house where the mother believed that if she put newspapers down, it won't get the floors dirty? So all you did was get the Chicago Trib dirty all day long, you know? The whole house, see? So all of a sudden, I'm aware of another way of life. Esther Jane Alberry's way. As opposed to our way. Now I am home. I can smell the cabbage. We lived on red cabbage. I could smell the red cabbage. And in her house, you smelled a kind of ineffable perfume of girl house. Only men know that, you know, that thing of going to a girl's house, and it's a girl's house. You can smell it, the whole thing, you know. Even the father looks different. Oh, yeah, I very early got used to that look, you know. I just walk in, seeing this guy would look at me. You can just see it. Is this going to be the one, you know? And so very early, you know, here's a scene, see, and I realize there's another way of life now. Now, all the other kids that I actually hung around, like Schwartz, Bruner, Flick, they all had houses just like mine. Absolutely the same. They had the basement. You remember the basement? Oh, what a great thing. I think that one of the things that is lacking in current education is that most kids are not growing up over a basement. There is nothing scarier than a basement. Oh, yeah, you're at home by yourself in the house, see? Now, if those of you who don't know what a basement is, I presume there are a few of you here who don't. A basement is a big hole in the ground under your house. If you can imagine a big, dark, smelly hole under the floor. And so when you walk around in a kitchen and you sit down, you're always sitting over this giant hole. And once in a while, you hear down in the basement, clunk. You're by yourself, you know. There's something in the basement. Then you walk a little bit, and then you hear clunk. Because down in the basement, the mice lived. Now, I've always felt that growing up over this thing gives man a concept of hell. There's no other way to fake it, you know? Oh, yeah, there's always something. Oh, I had a terrible thing happen to me in connection with the basement. Now, this is going to be a story that I don't know whether I should tell you because it's a frightening story. No, really, seriously. Oh, the basements are scary things. And one night, here's our house. You got it? It's sitting up on a terrace, kind of raised up. All the houses had raised terraces with these weeds that they called the lawn, you know, stickers. And there they were, see, one after the other. And each one was separated from the other by about, oh, you know, a driveway went through, that kind of thing. And it is now about, I'd say, 9 o'clock at night, maybe 9:30. And I've been somewhere with the guys. I'm probably 18 years old now, 70, just before I went in the Army. I'm walking home, and I see the house up there. There it is, quiet, see. I'm just coming home. I go up the front steps, absolutely silent. I walk in, not a sound in the house. There's nobody home, just me. So I go into the kitchen. And what's the first thing you do when you go in the kitchen? That's right. Man is very basic. Somehow I like the idea of even important guys. Can't you see Johnson at 2 a.m. sneaking in? He opens the refrigerator, you know, and he looks around, and an old lettuce falls out. You know, just like real life. So I opened up the refrigerator. You know, there's the usual stuff. Our entire world, our refrigerator always had, it had a saucer. And on the saucer, there was one hamburger. Well, it was just, not a hamburger, it was a meatball. And one bite had been taken out of it. And there was a thick rim of white grease that ran around it. So I look at that, you know. That's been in there since I was 8. Then there was a plastic, there was always a plastic container half full of old mashed potatoes with that thick crust on the top, you know. Then there was the lettuce. We always had that lettuce that invariably, when you open it up, it would bounce, see? I got so I could feel it on the short hop, you know, I just pulled like that. Instinctively, I'd go down, you know, I'd scoop it up. And it was a brown lettuce, you know, brown. I'd shove it back in the freezer compartment, and I looked, see? And then there was always, in the icebox, at ease up there, hold it, there was always a half a bottle of beer. My father invariably would drink half a bottle after he finished his other two, and he would leave a half a bottle there, and he had this cap that had come off. So every time I can remember at 2 a.m. opening the icebox, I would open it, it would fall over. And the beer would go, you know, a terrible thing. And then, here's the ice cream, the milk, you know, and the whole bit. So here it is. It's quiet. I'm all by myself. You know, it's a great feeling of being in the house by yourself. I look in the icebox, refrigerator. Okay, there's some salami. So I take the salami. I turn around. I put it down on the table, you know, and I chunk off a couple of chunks. I love salami, big, thick slices of it, see. You just eat it. I'm standing in the kitchen. And then you wash it down with the milk that's for breakfast. That's going to go over big about 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. You know, you know, I love that. You know, take a big chunk of salami. Boom, boom. I got the carton of milk. You know, there's that little rim now around of solidified salami juice. Where do they pour that over their Wheaties, you know? No, I got, you know, I'm standing there, and I've always felt, and this is maybe why, I guess, all my life, I felt that sneaking feeling that something's going to happen. You never know when it is, really. You just never do. And I was totally caught unprepared. I'm standing there, see, with the milk. All of a sudden, I hear, down in the basement, I hear something that sounds like a piece of metal falling. It just goes ding. I got the milk. Here's the basement door over here, see? It goes down the steps, and under the house is the basement. I stand for a minute, and then I hear coming up the front steps, I hear other footsteps. I hear thump, 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 thump. In walks my kid brother. You know, he comes walking in, you know. I say, hi, Rand. I say, shh, 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 shh. There's something in the basement. And he stops, you know. All of our lives, there had been that rumor, there's something in the basement. There never had been anything in the basement. But, you know, you always react. So Randy goes, that's his listening attitude. You know, I'm standing there with the milk. And then I start walking over towards the door, which leads to the basement. Then I decide, there's nothing down there. Now I'm back in front of the icebox. And then I hear coming down the street, ladies' shoes. You know the sound of ladies' shoes approaching? You know, tick, 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 tick. It's the sound of my mother coming, see? And I hear her come up the steps, and she goes tick, 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 tick into the living room. And here's Randy standing. And here I am, you know, this great tableau. My mother says, what's the matter? I said, Shma, there's something in the basement. And she says, oh, no. I said, yeah, you're right, no. Yeah. Yeah, you're right, no. See, so we all go into the kitchen, and she's telling us about the movie that she saw. We're sitting there now. It's all forgotten. I've now got in front of me, I've got a piece of sandwich or something. Just sitting there. And we're laughing. It's now about 10 o'clock at night. When all of a sudden, you hear, ding. Silence. My mother says, there's something in the basement. Randy says, my kid brother, no, that's the ladies. We almost caught another one, didn't we? You know, right at the top of one of my stories one night, a guy walked all the way through. You know, he's got this look. He walked right in there, and there was a brief pause, and you heard, ah! And they thought I staged it, you know. Well, here we are. You know, talk. There's something worrying that kid. He's had problems. I dreamt of my maiden form one day. But you know, seriously though, whenever I look at a horror movie, and you know, you see them all the time, very few of us ever live through a genuinely horror, really a horrifying moment. In other words, horror and fear is usually an abstract thing to most of us. We see it in movies. Yeah, we see it in plays. We read about it once in a while. You can't believe it when it's happening. And so here we are in the kitchen. And then there was another sound that immediately followed the second one, and it's a sound of something being dragged. Yeah, you could hear this piece of iron just went, ey. Well, now, you know, mice. I mean, you could go with the mouse theory just so far. Now, we had big mice, but, you know, there is no mouse down there stealing the bike. And you hear this sound down there. Oh, boy, what a scary moment. I was scared to death. I'm standing there, see, like this. Whew. Now, I'm the big guy in the family, see. I'm it. My father isn't home. There's just my mother. She's standing there. My kid brother's looking. There's me, see? And my mother says, Jeannie, do something. Well, you know, either you chicken out or you do. So here I am, and I walk to the front of the steps. I open the door, and it's pitch black down there. Absolutely pitch black. And it was one of those awful lighting arrangements. You had to go down on the first landing to light the light. So there it is. I can see the light switch right down on the landing, see? And here I am looking down in the dark. And I start going down like this. And you know, when you're trying to walk quiet, listen, you know, eek, eek, the steps go clunk. And then I hear scurrying. Oh, my God, no. You know, I hear a kind of rustling and a movement. Well, now I'm about two steps from the landing. And I decide to do something. I decide to risk it. I stuck my head down, and I can look now down into the basement, this big black hole down there. I look down. I can't see a thing. It's absolutely black. So I turn, and I look up at my mother, and I say, "Hey, Ma, turn the light out. Turn it out." And so she turns out the kitchen light. Well, that's what I wanted, see. Now the house is dark. You can see. I see the furnace over to the left. You know how the furnace looks, this giant monster. Had big arms, you know. That furnace is looking at me. I could just see it in shadow there. And I holler into the basement. "Who's there? Come on now." Silence. So I turn to my mother and I say, "There's nobody here." And then you hear another clunk. Oh, my God. Up the steps I go. Now I'm in the kitchen. And this was the moment of decision. What do you do now? It's obvious that somebody is in the basement. Absolutely obvious. I can't chicken out now. We do not have a telephone. No, you know. So what do? I stand in the kitchen for about 10 seconds. And I said, "Mom, go get the shotgun." Yep. We had this 410 shotgun. And so my kid brother runs into the bedroom. He comes out with it. And it's a little double-barreled 410. Full choke, in case you're interested. And he had 3 shells. He hands me the shells, and I put one in each chamber, and I click, I push it down. I now walk down onto the landing. I said, "Okay." Boy, was I scared. Oh, jeez. I said, "All right, now, I got a gun." I did, man. When somebody says that to you, you better believe them. I says, "I've got a gun. And either you come out of there, or I'm going to shoot." Dead silence. I walk down. Now I'm down on the basement floor. And off in the darkness, we had this end of the basement, you know, where my father kept old tires. You know, big tires hanging on the wall. He always figured one day he would get another Graham Page. And so he had tires and radiators and all kinds of junk and footballs and everything hanging on the wall. And I see this dark form. I just see it in the corner. I look down. I says, "Okay, I see you now." And I've got the gun. And all of a sudden, there's this fast movement. Something goes to my left, and I can see something going up. That's all I saw for that minute. And something coming toward me. It all happened like in a split second. And just like this, from down here, I went, kaboom! I mean it. I just went, boom! Have you ever shot a shotgun in a basement? I'll tell you, it just went, whoo! I could see this, you know, this boom, it rolled out. And this was just a little 410. And I staggered back, and I heard my mother scream upstairs. Yeah, you know, this was fantastic. I heard her scream, and I heard something grunt. I'll never forget that. I just heard something go, like that. And then, out the window, they went. There were two of them. They went right out. We had this basement window out, and I stood there. There we were, in the darkness. I got the gun. My kid brother is standing up at the top, and he's going, you know. And you can hear people all around next door. I heard windows going up, you know. Ain't many shotguns go off there in that neighborhood, you know. I hear these windows going up, and I hear people calling out. And then it hit me, turn on the light, the first time, see. And I turned on the light. And I walked down. And I'm standing there, and you could see the window. Still, it had been jimmied open, was flied open. They were gone. And all along the side of the wall was this thin red spray. All along the wall and along the floor. I stood there for a minute with my gun, my 410 shotgun that I got selling Cloverine salve. You know, this was that gun that was for rabbits, see? And my mother came down the stairs, and you could hear people all over now, all outside, yard and everything. And a couple policemen arrive. I got the gun. And the cop looks at me and he says, you know, that was dangerous. He says, the next time you hear somebody in the basement, you just lock the door and run out. He says, I'll never forget the time O'Reilly went down in the basement like that. He says, that's dangerous. I got this gun. I says, yeah. Sure is. And the next day, there was this piece in the paper. It says, schoolboy, with fantastic bravery, routs burglars. And all throughout school, people came up and said, boy, what guts. Let me tell you one thing. Deep inside of me was a little voice that said, yes, honey, I know. Deep inside was a little voice that said, if I knew they were down there, I would have been 7 miles away. And even at the moment that I shot that damn thing, I never really believed there was something there. I just thought it was, you know, a lot of excitement. But then I saw that big red thin spray on that wall. And ever since that time, I've had that little secret fear that down under the floor, there is somebody hiding in the coal bin. By the way, speaking of coal bins, what radio station is this? Come on in. And speaking of coal bins, what city is this? New York, you poor slobs in Pennsylvania. Isn't it great to be in New York? Hey, you guys in Ohio, we're here and you're there. Let's all together go, aww.
We're listening to Gene Shepherd live at the Village at Limelight 60 years ago today, September 10th. 1966, and you're hearing it in the dustbin of history right here on WBAI New York.
Well, you know, that terrible sense of fear that is an abstraction, that I've had that happen two or three times in my life where something occurs and you just cannot believe what's going on. And somebody over here about 10 minutes ago requested that I tell a story about the famous bugged radar that occurred to Company K. And it was one of those moments that I've had in my life that I will never forget as far as fear is concerned. You know, when I look down at you, you know, I can see you sitting there, and every one of you around you has got a little nimbus. Yeah, that's right. Your life is around you. And the things that have happened in your life are there. And each one of you has about five fantastic moments of fear that you remember, that you don't often bring out. We've all had them. Well, I'm in the Signal Corps. By the way, speaking of fear, you see the big gentleman in the corner there who's the night manager? There is a man who was a relief pitcher for the St. Louis Browns. Let's give him a hand. That's a fact. Mike Miola. Yeah, when I talk of fear, can you imagine the fear that Mike must have felt as he stands on the mound? Seriously, he did, you know. He stands on the mound ready to pitch in Yankee Stadium with the bases loaded with Yankees and Joe DiMaggio up. And behind him are the St. Louis Browns. Right, Mike, in the hand. That's the truth. Yeah, he pitched against DiMaggio, and he pitched against them all. As a matter of fact, he told me about the first time, the first big league ball game that he ever pitched. He was called up from the minors. And all of a sudden, here he's sitting out in the bullpen. And he's in the big leagues now. I'm talking about Mike over there. And he's sitting out in the bullpen in Comiskey Park, which is Chicago. His first big league game, see. And he's watching the White Sox. And by the way, he's pitching for the St. Louis Browns. Now, the Brownies and the White Sox in those days were twin sister teams of defeat. It was like futility battling defeat itself. Like oblivion going up against ennui. And here he is sitting out there in the darkness. Yeah, watching, waiting for his turn. And then his team's in trouble. The Browns were always in trouble. Right, Mike? They're the only team in the history of baseball, believe it or not, that had a one-armed outfielder. They did. That's right, Pete Gray. They also had a midget that batted, too. Yeah, I'm telling the truth. So, you think the Mets are something. Wow. So, Mike is called in. Now, I'll tell you a real story of the big league. Now, you don't often hear this kind of stuff. So, Mike is called in now. And he steps up to the plate. He steps up to the pitcher's mound. His first moment in the big leagues. Can you imagine how that feels? He looks around. And you know, it was a big doubleheader. The White Sox and the Brownies were fighting it out for seven. And you know, it was a big doubleheader, so there was over 400 people there. And so, yeah, so Mike looks around. Yeah, it's the big leagues. And standing up to the plate there is Luke Appling. This is one of the great all-time hitters. Luscious Luke. Luke, by the way, could foul off balls that weren't even pitched. That's true. They say that you wake Luke Appling up at 3 o'clock in the morning and he'll give you a foul ball. Right in the middle of the summer there, anytime. So Luke Appling is up. And here's Mike. Mike lets go of his first pitch in the big leagues. It caught the outside corner for a strike. He retired the side, and he walked off that mound feeling 20 feet tall. He made it. That's the truth. And he gets down in that dugout, and he sits down there. Boy, I did it. And the Brownies, of course, were out in a minute and a half. And now he goes back out to the mound again, see? That's a true story. So he gets out there, he stands up to the pitcher's mound. He's feeling, you know, he's really feeling his oats now. See? He winds up and he throws that first pitch into the screen. The first one. He throws the next one into the dirt. He walked the first man up. Now he's standing on first at Chicago White Sox runner. It's the first one that they've had on in years. And he's standing on first, see? Mike winds up, walks the next runner. He walks the third one. And now the manager comes out of the dugout. And he's feeling terrible. He's standing there. I remember the day that Mike told me this story. This is so true because I played a little pro ball myself, and I know this is what happens. The manager walked out of the dugout. He comes up to Mike. Have you often wondered what they say out there? Here's what he said to Mike. Just give me the ball. Just give me the ball. And Mike tosses him the ball. He says, and here's Mike standing. He says, pick up your head. He says, keep your head up. You're a big leaguer. He says, put your head up. Don't you look down at the ground. And don't you leave the mound until your relief pitcher gets up here. You're a big leaguer. Mike stood there. The reliever came in. He walked off the field. There was a little smattering of applause. And Mike knew that that moment was true. He had become a big leaguer. Let's give him a hand. That's a true story. Oh, yeah. But, you know, those moments, that kind of fear that comes once... You know, you can only know real fear if you risk things. Most people play it pretty safe. I've known most people I know in their lives play it so close to the vest that they're never going to have any excitement in their lives. They're never going to have any fear. They're not going to have any real danger. They play it cool, always. In fact, I it must be great to be in an audience. That's one of the reasons why I like to go to a show once in a while. I'm sitting down in the audience, and there's this terrible show going on. And I sit down and I say, you can't blame me. I didn't do it. That ain't me doing it, man, you know. Great feeling. Well, I think that's one of the reasons why so many people today are afraid of the Army. Because the Army ain't secure. And most people's lives today are pretty secure. The average kid, you know, from the time he's four, he's already enrolled in a college. Yeah, he's probably already got B's in his second year. He's only three, you know. They've already arranged that, see? So naturally, the Army is a mysterious place. They don't guarantee you nothing. Anything. Not a thing. And so here... No, you don't. Not necessarily a bad time, fellow. That depends on you. No, that's... I'm sorry. You probably got skin trouble, too. And mix ad libs with a pro, and you're going to wind up coleslaw. So, I'm in this company. See, now you never hear about Signal Corps companies, because almost every movie is made about the Air Force, or it's made about the infantry, and you see Aldo Ray. How many wars has Aldo Ray been in? I mean, Aldo Ray has clocked more damn time in a steel hat, you know. Every movie, you get a war movie, you get Aldo Ray. You get, who else do you get? Let's see, James Whitmore. He plays the sergeant. Sometimes you can even get an aging Van Johnson to play the second lieutenant. You got a war movie going, see. Well, it isn't exactly that way in real Army life. I'm in Company K, which is a Signal Corps company. Well, the thing that Signal Corps companies fought was not so much the enemy, but their fantastic equipment. Oh, God. I'll tell you, we had this was a radar company, and we had a piece of radar gear that would have filled the entire limelight. It was fantastic. This thing stood maybe 30 feet high, just to the base. And then on top of it, it had these huge wings. You ever seen radar in movies? Had these great antennas that would sweep. Night after night, they just sweep. And you get a little afraid of your own equipment. Yeah, it's scary. It would just go night after night. It had this 440 cycle note that would just ring and go. Night after night. And over here in the bushes, they had this big Leroy engine, which was a generator. And that thing would go night after night. You'd hear, joop, 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 joop. And that was our world. I'd walk up to it. And you know, you alternately love and you hate this damn thing. You know how your car is? Sometimes you hate it and sometimes you love it. and you don't know quite what you do? Well, we would walk past this thing. Or we would sit up in the seats. There were three of us sitting in it. There would be the azimuth man. There would be the direction. There would be the man who's in charge of altimeters, altitude. And night after night, we'd watch these scopes. But one thing we had that we were scared to death of, we had a power supply. Have you ever walked past places where it says high voltage, danger, beware? Well, we had a power supply that stood about that high, maybe. And it was about, oh, I'd say from here to the wall deep, to where that moose is looking at me. Looks a little like our duty corporal. No, it was a huge thing, and on the side, it had a variac. And you could vary the voltage on this thing from 1 volt, are you ready for it? You could run it up to 15,000 volts at 5 amperes. Now that is, that could light all of Syracuse. And we used to turn it up, see? And you see the meters going up. And this power supply would start to jiggle. All of us would back away a little bit. It would go. And these antennas, you know, these antennas are going. And when we get this thing up to full voltage, there was a big red line. It says danger. We get it up to the red voltage at 15,000 volts. On certain nights, when it was a certain kind of temperature, certain kind of atmosphere, St. Elmo's Fire would play. You ever seen St. Elmo's Fire? I'll tell you, the first time I saw it, I thought my Aunt Min had come back. Yeah, St. Elmo's Fire is a flickering blue flame that plays up and down on the radar masts. It just flickers. It's like a little tiny piece of hell. Yeah, just flickering blue-green flame, and it moves up and down. We'd stand there and look at this damn thing. It was Emily. We called our radar set Emily, hoping by calling it Emily, it would be nice to us. You know, here is this big thing. Well, one day it happened. There's always the fear that something's going to happen. It's going to happen. And in our technical manual at the end, it said, in case of disaster. Yeah, and they had a whole list of things that could happen, like the power supply blow up and the CO get killed. Yeah, and not only that, but there was another thing that must be said about our radar set. It was totally bugged. It had dynamite strung all around inside of it in little metal capsules. And it had a special red button. And that button was for in case you're about to get captured. You press that, run, and it blows up, you know? And so we'd see that thing there all the time. Can you imagine living with a thing like that all day long? You know? And it would just stand at night. It would go, 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 go. And then you'd hear somebody up there muttering. You'd hear him cursing. Yeah, you get so that you hate it. And I would hear a GI. I remember Gasser sitting up there. And it's spinning around. You're about 40 feet above the ground. And it's sweeping the skies. Out of those fantastic, hot, tropical skies, it's searching. And you can hear Gasser. All he's doing is go, he's using the only word he used all through his Army career. He was alternately cursing this damn machine, the life that he was living, the heat, the sun, the rash. Each one of us had a heat rash. I'll tell you, I remember standing in the morning for Reveille. I remember scratching my heat rash up here. It started about 3 feet above my head and went right down into the ground. You could feel it, see, that heat rash, and it'd be crawling all over you, you know. And we're wearing nothing but shorts, and we got our dog tags, and the heat, and once in a while you'd hear an alligator. You ever heard the mating cry of a bull alligator? Oh, that adds so much to life. Oh, yeah, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, I would be getting up on my... I'd be on the night shift, you know, and I'd be sitting down in that metal seat. I'd start adjusting the contrast on my scope, you This, I wonder how many millions of guys who are X-radar operators can't stand TV sets. You know, where it says contrast. I'm adjusting this thing. And then you'd hear out in the darkness, that's a bull alligator trying to make a connection. And then you'd hear in the distance, you'd hear, and then gas, you'd say, oh, romance. Isn't that great? And you should hear, if you think that the sound of the mating cry is something you ought to hear when they're having a date. Boy, that's really exciting, you know? And you'd hear this at 2 o'clock in the morning all the time, and we had this little duck board. I remember one night, you know, I'm lying in the tent with my heat rash. You know, you can get a heat rash, you get so that you're fond of it. And I'd lie there and I'd scratch my heat rash, see, in the dark, and it would talk to me. Yeah, it was kind of like a pet, see, and I would put sulfa salve on it like that, and it's there, it's okay now. Oh, my friend, you're the only thing that stuck with me for 2 years, you know. Yeah, I was out of the armor for 5 years before I got rid of the last piece of it, you know. And I could feel the fungi growing up my back. I had a little garden right back here. And I'd hear the mosquitoes. And one night I hear these feet. I hear these feet coming along the duck boards. It's a corporal coming back and he's tanked. I hear this, you know, coming back like that. And then I hear, whoa! And he says, yes, sir. He stood out there 10 minutes in the dark and talked to that alligator. He thought it was the first sergeant. And it was that, you know, that kind of life. And all the while, we're sort of drifting along in the darkness, you know. And at the same time, we were always afraid something would happen. And once in a while, an airplane would go over and buzz us. And we could hardly believe it, see. Somebody would be at the scope and he'd say, bogey at 184. And the lieutenant would say, oh, knock it off, will you? And then you'd hear, ooh, we'd look, oh, no. One day they're going to spot us. They're going to know we're here. And this thing is slowly revolving. And then it happened. It happened on a beautiful, soft, early fall day. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we had been off the air for about 6 hours for maintenance. Our radar set was down. And the entire company is out there. We got our shorts on, our dog tags. We've been doing this for 100 years. And our old battered radar set standing there with the big wings just looking. And it's silent. It ain't saying nothing. Just laying there. And Lieutenant Cherry, who was our executive officer, is walking around. He's got his shorts on, you know. It's all we wear. We're in the jungle. He's walking back and forth. He said, okay. He said, all you guys on the power, he says, let's load up the power now. And he's running up to 5,000 volts. And we'll start the tune up. That, you never see this side of the Army, do you? We'll start the tune up. And 6 guys climb up, including me. I am now up on the top of this thing, about 45 feet above the ground. That's about 4 stories in the air. And I'm standing up on a little board with all these dipole antennas around me. We're going to tune it up. And I'm standing up there, see, and I've got a couple of meters. Over here is Gasser. He's got a couple of meters. And down on the ground is Edwards and Zinsmeister. They got telephones. And they got meters. And off in the boondocks is another guy holding up a signal generator. This is our little company doing its duty. We are defeating the forces of evil. We are giving Hitler hell. He's got this thing. Lieutenant Cherry says, all right, you guys on the power supply, run it up to 4,000 volts now. Let's go. And you check the ring oscillator over there. And I look down. I'm standing up there, and I see this PFC go up to the big handle of the Variac. He turns it. the power supply goes... It starts to jiggle, see? It's working. The tubes are lighting now. It's beginning to breathe life, you know. It's like King Kong is beginning to start. It's Popeye with a thing full of spinach. I'm up on the top there, and I'm adjusting my meter. It says, all right, okay, let's start now. I'm reading 0.1. Gas is reading 0.3. 0.7, yeah. Move, food. Everything is going normal. And I want to tell you this. It is at the moments when things go normal is when disaster strikes. Our little company was living its life. You could smell the mess. Our lunch was being made. SOS. Yeah, you could smell it. It was all part of it. You could smell the gasoline. Yeah, that they used for the kerosene that went into the French toast. And then Lieutenant Cherry, who's walking around down below, he said, all right, you guys, on the stick. Here we go. 10,000. And it's going. And you can just feel it vibrate. You know, you just feel that whole thing start to jiggle. 10,000 volts are going into this ring oscillator. And you can see the nimbus starting to grow. You can feel the fillings of your teeth. They're starting to whistle Dixie, you know? You know, it's... Then Cherry says, all right, all the way up. All right, wash your meters, you guys, all the way up. And I remember just seeing Cherry turn like this. And just as he turned, the guy went up like that. It went up to the red, and I've got my meter. It says, 0.7. Then you hear in the distance a sound. It went... It's getting bigger and bigger, and it's coming out of the power supply. Gas says, my God, no! Lieutenant Cherry was sort of looking like this. He turned around, and for that instant, he became a PFC. I'll tell you, Cherry went over the bushes. He went into the swamp. He went behind the latrine. He went right into the enlisted man's latrine. That showed you how scared he was. And the thing went, woo! And I heard the first side say, hey, get down over there, you guys. It's going up. I dropped the meter, you know. Gasser drops his. We made that four stories in about a second and a half. I hit the ground, you know. I remember getting up and running it, and I could hear this thing go, woo! We're laying flat. The entire company is dug in now. And there's old Emily. And it continued to scream. And then it paused for a minute. And I could hear Lieutenant Cherry muttering in the distance. He could see those captain bars going forever. Oh, God, no. Oh, my radar set's blown up. Oh, what kind of a statement of charges is that going to be? Oh, and then it went... There it was at 15,000 volts. There was about a 10 millisecond pause, and then it went boop. That's all. A little puff of smoke. And the radar set continued to run. And suddenly it dawned on all of us. One of those little whoopee bombs. Have you ever seen those advertised in the back pages of the Popular Mechanics? It says, surprise and mystify your friends. Somebody in the Signal Corps, had caused a fantastic laundry bill. All right, let's hear it.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news. Sure, you can make believe you're on Broadway. Hang a few strings of flashing lights across your living room. Get a few neighbors to rush around and bump into each other. Tape a few movie stills onto your wall. Or you can listen to Jack O'Brien, the voice of Broadway, each weekday afternoon at 2:15 over WORAM 710. Jack, literally a man about town, makes the Broadway scene, and the people he meets along the way stop by to chat with him on his radio show. They exchange stories with Jack, talk about what's happening out there, and explain how they got started in their careers. Actors, actresses, designers, artists, musicians, authors, they're all always welcome, very welcome. Now, rather than concentrating on the technical side of their work, Jack takes a look at the human side. As a result, the O'Brien Gallery of Portraits is a memorable one. Jack O'Brien in the Critics Circle, that's each weekday afternoon at 2:15. The life and times of the Broadway set over WOR-AM, 710 on your radio dial in New York. At the WOR time signal, exactly 12 o'clock midnight.
Attention, all members of the underworld. If you happen to see Jimmy Breslin, tell him to call the World Journal Tribune. We're publishing Monday.
This is Andy Lesberg, and it's nighttime. And tonight we're repeating one of our more recent shows that have been that apparently you evinced a lot of interest in by your phone calls and letters, and we hope you enjoy it.
And that was Gene Shepherd, live at the Village Limelight 60 years ago to the day, September 10th, 1966, and that's it. I don't know if we're out of time, but I give up. I want to go home at some point so I can get some sleep and attend my stupid meeting tomorrow. Or actually, it's already happened as you hear this. But I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. Thanks for tuning in. Next week, another lost episode of Gene Shepherd from one collection or another. That was, by the way, recorded by Rudy. The reason it sounded not so great was because a week or two earlier, the law, the FCC, ruled that you could no longer simulcast FM radio and AM. So Shepherd was relegated to the AM side of WOR and all those nice, clean recordings from pre-August 1966 were no more. Okay, but next week, who knows? Maybe back to the Heinz collection, we'll be back to the Inner Sanctum. Another episode of Exploring Tomorrow. We'll get back to Beyond the Green Door. And who knows what else. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. Thanks for listening.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal.